Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this week, the Utah Senate okayed Healthy Utah, Governor Herbert's Medicaid alternative. But as soon as it hit the House, Speaker Greg Hughes put up a roadblock. Is Healthy Utah dead on arrival? Meanwhile, medical marijuana squeaked by a Senate committee on a 3-2 vote, and the bill's sponsor admits to using in Colorado to relieve back pain. What chances will the bill have in the full Senate? The Salt Lake City Council reveals its plan for the city's financially strapped golf courses. We'll find out more about proposed course closures. And fractures continue to appear in the Pioneer Park Coalition. The week's top stories, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we're talking medical marijuana, Healthy Utah, golf, Pioneer Park, and a lot more. And joining me to talk about the week's news is Tribune senior political reporter Robert Gerke. Hello, Robert.
Good morning.
Also with us, government and politics editor Dan Harry is with us. Dan, good morning.
Morning, Jennifer.
Government reporter Christopher Smart is back. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. And health and education editor Rebecca Walsh is with us as well. Hi, Rebecca.
Good morning.
And you can join us, too, if there's a news story on your mind. You can send questions, comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter. You can put your comments on the website, sltrib.com, or give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's start with Healthy Utah. The Healthy Utah bill, which is Governor Herbert's alternative to Medicaid expansion, offering health coverage to the poor, did push through the Senate this week. And Rebecca, what were the winning arguments?
I think the winning arguments were the number of people that it would cover and the fact that this money would go by the wayside if Utah doesn't adopt some sort of expansion of Medicaid. What happened yesterday that was interesting is the sponsor of a much lesser bill, the medically frail bill that would cover 10,000 Utahns, about a tenth of what the governor's plan would cover, failed to be moved up in sort of a legislative gamesmanship. Senator Allen Christensen wanted to put it on the third reading calendar just so that it would be ready in case Healthy Utah didn't pass. And senators rejected that and said, no, we're sticking with the Healthy Utah bill we've already passed and we've sent it on. The House is going to have to deal with it.
Okay, well, the House, I guess, is not going to deal with it. No sooner had the measure advanced to the House than Speaker Greg Hughes effectively said, now this bill is dead. Why did he say that the bill would not be debated on the House floor, Robert?
Well, the House has had at least three closed caucus meetings about to discuss their positions on the Healthy Utah bill. And there's just no support for it in the body. In fact, when the governor they had a meeting in December before the session started, and from that time until until this week, the bill has actually lost support in the House. So the governor's in a deeper hole than he was to begin with. And so Greg Hughes said that there's no point bringing a bill out just to kill it. You know, that's just ceremony, and he says that he's not interested in that. And so as far as the House is concerned, as far as House leadership is concerned, it's not going to get a hearing or a vote.
To accommodate some of the concerns, the governor has changed Healthy Utah slightly.
Yeah.
What were some of those accommodations?
Well, he's calling it Healthy Utah 2.0, and originally it was a 3-year pilot program that could be repealed if the legislature chose to do so. The concern from some was that that would take a lot of political pain, cause a lot of political pain for people to, you know, jerk health insurance away from 150,000 people. And so now it's a 2-year sunset, and they would have to affirmatively go in and reauthorize it. And his argument is, well, that gives us some time to get the program off the ground, find out how many people it can help, how much it's going to cost. It gets us into a new administration in 2017, and we can see if there's a Republican president who's going to give us more flexibility. So there's the 2-year sunset. He says it can be covered entirely within the existing budget of the Department of Health. Apparently, it's going to cost $25 million for the 2 years. And so those were two things that concessions he made, I guess, to sort of try to bring some people along. It worked in the Senate, obviously. The House is still not convinced. And so, you know, Speaker Hughes said the 2-year sunset doesn't really change anything because you're still going to be taking insurance away from these people who are on the program. They're going to be committee hearings and public protests, you know, bringing in sick people who are, have cancer and they're going to take away their insurance. And he says that's just not a tenable solution. And so it's still, I don't know, maybe on life support's the term for it, you know, in the House. There's still, nothing's ever dead until the session's over. And the governor said yesterday he'd consider calling special sessions and bring him back in to consider it if he needs to. So there's, I guess you could say maybe it still has a pulse, but it's not looking good for healthy Utah in the House.
Obviously, it's on life support. And Rebecca, what's been the reaction? The governor's not happy. How are people in the health care community reacting to Speaker Hughes sort of blocking this bill?
Well, I think they knew it was going to be a long haul and are sort of cautiously optimistic maybe that now that the political machinations are going on and the power struggles playing out, that perhaps there's a chance that the governor will use all his political capital and somehow resurrect it. But
yeah, he's used it. It's been interesting to watch because, and maybe Dan can comment on this, I don't know that I've seen a governor really use this much political capital on any program. And this is not a program that Republicans typically embrace across the country. And he's put a lot on the line to try to get this through. There is still a full court press going on up at the Hill. You see the representatives from the Hospital Association and you see representatives from the different advocacy groups still, you know, aggressively lobbying the House members to try to get the support this would need to get to a vote. I think you'll see Democrats in the body in the House try to lift it out to bring it directly to the floor, just to have some vote on the record on this bill. You probably will see that maybe next week, and so there's still some maneuvering that can go on, and so you know it's not dead. The governor's going to continue pushing for it, and these groups are pushing maybe even harder now than they were before. Some of that sort of rubbed some of the members of leadership the wrong way. The Alliance for a Better Utah sent a mailer to Representative Jim Dunnigan's constituents. Jim Dunnigan is the House Majority Leader. He's also sort of the point man on health care issues in the House. And it was pretty hard-hitting, you know. It said that he's going to deny health care to, you know, these needy families and that he's putting his political interests or personal interests first. And so, you know, that rubbed Speaker Hughes the wrong way, said these dark money groups are targeting, you know, trying to bully representatives into supporting something that they shouldn't support. So there's going to continue to be a back and forth. And you know, there's still 13 days at least of the legislative session. Maybe miracles can happen.
Maybe miracles can happen. Dan Harry, I mean, have you seen this kind of roadblock before? Comment on the power play between Speaker Hughes and the governor.
Well, yeah, you guys haven't mentioned that. And if you read Robert's story this morning, you know, the first time now this has been raised that these two issues, Healthy Utah and the prison relocation, have been sort of linked behind the scenes. Greg Hughes, who represents Draper, very much wants to get the prison moved out of his district. It is probably the number one agenda item for him personally as a representative. And so I think the governor is very aware of that, and he's been a longtime supporter of moving the prison. I mean, you know, the first we've heard about this in recent times about moving the prison was when John Huntsman was first running for governor in 2004, and it happened in the out of nowhere when Gary Herbert was named as his running mate. And the suspicion was that's where the idea came from. And the governor has supported, you know, this process for a long time. All of a sudden now he said, well, you know, leaving the prison where it is a viable option. And I'd give it about a 50-50 shot that it's gonna stay where it is. That is exactly the thing that Greg Hughes does not want to hear. And, you know, there has been all this time and effort and energy putting into studying locations. So now, you know, it looks, and Greg Hughes is questioning whether the governor is using this as a political football.
Is there credibility for that, Robert? I mean, is he just pushing that pressure point with Speaker Hughes?
You know, you can't really crawl inside the governor's head and figure out what the motivation is, I guess. But there seems to be there's no doubt among many of the representatives I spoke to yesterday that this clearly is an effort by the governor to turn the heat up on Speaker Hughes. I mean, there is one big lever that he has, you know, that's the leverage he's got on moving the prison. You know, and so, I think there is a little bit of gamesmanship here. You know, the governor has been, as Dan said, very supportive of moving it in the past. He's put it in his State of the State addresses and said very publicly that he thinks it's time to move it. And now he's cooled on that considerably. And the timing of that is suspect, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. This sort of hostage taking happens up on the Hill. These are two huge hostages, very high profile issues, very high stakes game of chicken that they're going to be playing here for the last 2 weeks of the session. Hmm.
Rebecca, I mean, what does this mean for Healthy Utah? Are there other alternatives? You mentioned the Christensen bill sort of floundered in the Senate. Is anything else cropping up? Any other suggestions?
Well, we had heard that Dunnigan may be trying to come up with his own. I don't know if he's still pursuing that. The medically frail bill is still there. I suppose if at the last moment they decide, okay, Healthy Utah's dead, we've got to do something, they might be able to pull it out. But
yeah, there could still be a bill coming out of the House. Representative Spendlove has a bill that would cover the 100% of poverty. It's still in rules right now. They're just kind of waiting to see what happens with the other issues. I think you could see some attempt to try to get people to rally behind a sort of modified version of Christensen's bill coming out of the House. But at this point, it's kind of hard to see. Senator Niederhauser said yesterday that the Senate supports the Healthy Utah bill, and
so the Senate president is not getting into the tit for tat.
He is. He's said that the Senate supports the Healthy Utah bill. It passed. I think the vote was 20-8 or 19-8 over there, and they want to see it have a vote. And he said, with the House rules, allow the Speaker to block bills, and over here in the Senate we can do the same thing. So that was sort of a veiled allusion to a potential showdown there too. He's going to use a little bit of pressure, I think, on the Speaker as well. So there's still a lot of games to be played with this, and I would expect that you'll probably see within the next week or so sort of an outpouring of sort of the human side of this debate. You're going to start seeing some of the people who could be covered and who aren't covered now, who have suffered from debilitating or even life-threatening or perhaps even fatal illnesses because they don't have the coverage, sort of making their voices heard, because there's talk of using that to kind of even turn up more apply more public pressure to the House members.
Hmm. 13 days and counting. All right, let's move to the prison since you brought it up, Dan Harry. Lawmakers on the Prison Commission announced this week that they want to decide a new site for the prison outside of the legislative process. And what's the reasoning there?
Well, their official explanation is that this relocation commission, which is made up of, I don't know what the full membership is, but it has 7 voting members, and they are all legislators. And they have spent a lot of time looking at this and taking a lot of heat. And, they sort of signed up for it. They knew they were going to take this heat. And so they're all about, we're doing this in an objective, fair way. We hired outside consultants that are experts to look at these various sites. And we're trying to keep politics out of it, which, is not true. I mean, you can't keep politics out of this. But so their explanation is they want to, have this sort of expert now commission make the decision. And it's kind of a remarkable thing because, you're talking about a major public policy that you would essentially have the legislature delegating to a small group of people. The governor, again yesterday, in this kind of back and forth, said if, in fact, the legislature moves to do this, to hand the authority to this commission to make the final decision, he'll veto it. And I think that's the first time he's used the V word this session.
Yeah, definitely this session. And so the thinking is they've got it narrowed to 3 sites. They're going to expand the list a little bit, and they say that the science is going to drive this. Senator Jerry Stevenson said yesterday he didn't see much point in taxpayers paying, I believe it's $30,000, to call a special session just to have the legislature come in and basically rubber stamp a a decision that's been made by the commission, because they're not going to, you know, override the commission's thinking. The governor said that the legislature, the elected official, because this is an issue that affects the entire state, it's a huge, going to be a huge amount of money spent on building a new prison and relocating the prison, that the legislature, the elected representative, should be involved in it, and he, as the governor, should have the final say, yes or no, on where it goes. So, he said he would veto the bill. Representative Wilson and Senator Stevenson said they plan to meet with the governor to discuss his concerns a little bit, and we'll watch that one, too.
Narrowed down to three sites, one of which is in Salt Lake City. Chris Smart, Salt Lake City Hall, really putting the full court press against choosing the West Salt Lake City site.
They are. I don't know, however, how much pull they have up on Capitol Hill. Salt Lake City traditionally has not had a lot of pull up there. They're digging in their heels. Earlier this week, actually, the council passed another resolution saying they didn't want the prison in Salt Lake City. They just think it's a bad fit, and they are really against having it up here. Their reasoning is, I'm not sure. It's kind of like the reason everybody doesn't want it. Everybody thinks it's bad for business and drives down real estate and sort of takes away other options for the future, and I think property tax is probably the least of it. That they mostly they just see it as this black eye, so that you would fly into this beautiful new Salt Lake City International Airport and the first thing you see is a big prison.
Official reason, though, is very different than that. They say that it's mostly about geology, that the water table, where the site that they're looking at out west of the airport, has a high water table, and that you really couldn't build a safe facility out there, like a major facility like this. So that's their official reason, and you know, I mean, there's some legitimacy to that. They have geological studies that show that's to be the case. So. Mm-hmm.
But another site, which is east of there,
that site's off the table.
Is it?
Yeah.
But I know that they even posited that. That a tsunami on the Great Salt Lake could wash the prison away.
You know, a scientist at the University of Utah said, yeah, maybe not likely, but actually it's possible.
It is possible. So where does the prison debate stand right now? I mean, it's in flux, I suppose.
Well, Robert's later today going to go attend a prison relocation commission, and they are expected to add a couple more sites to that. The protests of the existing three that are the finalists has been such that, you know, this commission has just been hammered over it. And I think that's one of the reasons they want to hand this decision to the commission, because, you know, most rank-and-file legislators don't want to get hammered like this. It's kind of the same thing that you could argue is going on with the Healthy Utah is, you know, they don't want to put an up or down vote out there on the floor. So, and that's kind of the argument that the governor's making on both of these issues, and you know, it's kind of a pretty good argument to be making.
Mm-hmm.
The commissioners seem very committed to getting it moved and coming to a decision, but it will be probably a few months before we actually see some of the geological studies, and especially if they're throwing new sites in, it's going to kind of set it back a little bit further. So we're probably looking, you know, later this year before we get to that point.
Any sense when where those new sites are?
I believe one of them's in Utah County, and the other one,
Tooele, I think.
Tooele,
a separate
yeah.
one in Tooele.
Yeah, there. One of them is just sort of an expanded footprint for an existing site that they've already looked at before. So you know, they said that they looked, I believe, at 30 additional potential sites, and kind of weeded through them and found that these sort of two, well, the one modified site and the one new site are the really the only options that fit what they were looking for.
Interesting discussion, and seeing how it's developed with all the political power plays. So you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Again, you can join us to 801-355-TALK or send a tweet to the hashtag TripTalk. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me today, reporters Christopher Smart, Robert Gerke, also with us, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and health and education editor Rebecca Walsh. And we're talking about the week's top stories here in Utah, and you can join us by calling 801-355-TALK or sending a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. Let's talk about medical marijuana. I wish I had some music to cue up because that just inspires something in me. By a 3-2 vote, a Senate committee approved a bill that would legalize medical marijuana here. How would it work? What is the system being proposed? What would it look like? Rebecca.
Senator Mark Madsen says that the state would regulate it from seed to sale. And he talks about setting up a system that includes dispensaries and growing rooms and heavy regulations and taxing. And he has a solution for the banking problems that Colorado has run into. Basically, people who want to use medical marijuana would have some sort of registry certification from their doctors. They would put money onto a card that they could take to a dispensary and get their medical marijuana product. And it was sort of a closed loop that would be different from what Colorado is doing. So it survived the Senate Judiciary Committee. I think there's some question about how much farther it can go. One of the senators on the committee yesterday suggested sending it to interim. I wouldn't be surprised if that may be the route that it goes. But the other thing that was interesting from yesterday's meeting is the number of people who showed up and said that they're using medical marijuana. I think that may be surprising to lawmakers to see how many Utahns are going to efforts to try to get medical marijuana.
Give us a taste of some of that testimony, because it did get quite emotional at times.
Well, you have quite a few cancer patients, a mother of five who found out she had Hodgkin's lymphoma when she was 18 weeks pregnant and ended up moving to Colorado and then to California to get medical marijuana. She's an LDS mother from Utah County who believes that medical marijuana, cannabis, is better for her than chemotherapy. Then you have a man who's 42 and chemically castrated and dying of prostate cancer, who's terrified that because he uses medical marijuana, his house will be seized and his wife and kids will have nowhere to live. Those stories are pretty compelling.
Yeah. The gentleman who testified, Forrest, is a high school friend of mine. We went to high school together.
Wow.
I mean, he was diagnosed back, I believe, in December, maybe November. And it's been, you know, it's a terminal diagnosis.
It's horrible.
And he's going through a lot of treatments, obviously, and has been using it to sort of blunt the pain, you know, restore an appetite and deal with some of the side effects of it. And so you heard a lot of these people who are using it now. They're getting
you
it.
You have 16-year-olds with brain tumors who are dying, yeah, and their parents want to ease their pain.
And so I think, you know, it was powerful testimony. The sponsor, Senator Madsen, who himself said that he recently he suffered back pain for a number of years and recently went to Colorado on the advice of a doctor and tried it.
And then had to dump it as he crossed the state line and wasn't happy about that.
And so, you know, he says, you know, he's convinced that, what he basically says, if the doctor's convinced that it would be beneficial to the patient, then the state shouldn't step in the way of that. And so that's what he envisions. He's convinced he has the votes in the Senate to pass it. You know, we'll see where they come down. I would be a little bit surprised by that, but he's obviously been working on it more than I have.
And so there's a lot of pushback from law enforcement. The DEA is pushing back. The Police Chiefs Association is pushing back.
Didn't Mark Shurtleff show up there?
Mark Shurtleff was there.
Did he testify?
I don't know if we
Mark
didn't quote
Shurtleff,
him.
Mark Shurtleff, he didn't testify. He showed up. He's been a proponent of this for
a long
time. I believe
time.
A year and a half, 2 years ago.
Because of his own back pain, or?
I think it was because he went through some cancer treatments, right?
Yeah, he did.
And so I think he was, and also he was after his motorcycle accident, diagnosed some pretty hardcore opioids, and those were unpleasant, I guess.
Dan? I just wanted to single out one quote that the mother that Rebecca was talking about. I think her name was Tennille Farr, and she's moved back to Utah in Spanish Fork. And I used it on our Herd on the Hill feature today. She said, "I would like the freedom to be able to choose cannabis over chemotherapy." And I thought that was a pretty powerful statement.
Yeah. Cannabis over chemotherapy. So we've got both sides weighing in here. Robert, the governor, spoke out on this bill. What did he say?
Well, he's concerned about the slippery slope argument, right? That if you legalize this, it leads to recreational use. It doesn't. It might encourage more young people to use it. He said he's talked to Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado. They're co-chairs of the National Governors Association, and Governor Hickenlooper advised him that, you know, you need to be very careful with this and go slow. He's looked at what California's done. They've had problems with the program there. And so he's come out opposed to it. And he says, you know, it needs to be, you know, medical treatment needs to be handled by a doctor, not Dr. Feelgood, as he said yesterday. And
but to be clear, this is not something you smoke, right?
Well, one of the concessions that Senator Mattson made in the bill is that you cannot smoke
it. It's not smokable.
However, you can do the vaporizer pens with the oil in it. You can do the edibles, you know, gummy bears or lozenges. You can do, you know, that sort of thing. There are other ways to administer this. So the not smoking it thing is a bit of a concession, but the sponsors and some of the supporters are still convinced that they can get their THC, which is the ingredient that they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca?
Well, I'm intrigued by where the LDS Church may or may not be on this. I think it's going to take some sort of sense of their position on this. Is it just going to be like liquor stores? I mean, the way Mattson describes them, they're even more regulated than liquor stores. But if they could establish something like that, would the LDS Church be okay with that?
And I probably shouldn't speak out of line. My understanding is that the LDS Church, when it comes to members using that for medical purposes, has basically said that's between a person and their doctor. But
Well, and we did have a mother who said she is LDS and feels that she's within the boundaries of what her faith would tell her to do. So,
interesting debate. And yes, I'll be interested to see what the chances are that this could actually get through the Senate, advance to the House. Again, we're talking about the week's news. 801-355 Talk is our number. Let's go to Steve calling from Salt Lake City. Steve, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for holding.
Yeah, my pleasure. Just kind of going back to the prison relocation issue. I just think that there's a level of, I'm a little bit concerned about the fact that if you bought property in Draper 20 years ago, and there was a prison there 20 years ago. And now if the area has developed, Riverton, Draper area, that whole area down there, this development has been a lot of investment, different companies have built out there. And, of course, there's been all kinds of development in terms of residential as well as industrial or mercantile real estate. That's great, but there was a prison out there. And that's the whole point. They bought their land and they bought their homes and developed knowing there was a prison out there. And now they're saying, oh, wait, we don't want the prison here anymore. We want to expand and use that land for commercial purposes and invest in it and develop it. And I just think there's a level of absurdity where it's like, you know, you're not, there's a prison there. The prison should stay there. And that's all there is to it. If the prison needs to be updated and become more modern, that's where it should happen. And I'm opposed to it being relocated because I think it's just a little bit ridiculous that they fit now that this area has become developed. I think that we've got enough sprawl already all over the valley. And I don't think it's a constructive thing to relocate the prison. Now, that said, if there was a location maybe in the West Desert or out, you know, in the Salt Flats, they were going to solar power it, there was some kind of really cool argument to relocate it, other than this sort of enterprise in the South Valley, I might support that.
Okay,
but
Steve.
I just wanted to throw that into the mix.
I appreciate that.
You taking my call.
Thank you so much for calling. 801-355-TALK. Common arguments against moving the prison. Why not expand it on its current site? People knew that the development was occurring when there was a prison there. Why is it now the time to move it? What are the arguments for moving, Dan?
Well, the arguments for moving, and they were made yesterday by corrections officials as they took the media on a tour of the facility, is that if you want to do these new criminal justice reforms that they're talking about with emphasis on treatment and emphasis on programming for the inmates, that you need an entirely different configuration that is not suitable for the current location, you know. But you hear others, including a corrections employee who wrote an op-ed piece today in the paper, that said, "Hey, you know, this current site works fine. You could, if you need to reconstruct those buildings, you could do it side by side with the existing ones. There's plenty of room out there, so let's do it. So, you know, there are what sound like pretty good arguments on both sides. Steve's point that, you know, that you knew that when you moved there, so stick with it. You know, you could make that argument about anything. You could make the argument about where the prison originally was in Sugar House. You could make the argument about where farms were in most of this valley for many, many years. And, you know, it's just, it's the natural process of the population explosion that's going on in this valley. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. To the caller's point about putting it out in the desert somewhere, it's not feasible because you need to be close to where workers can live and commute to the prison. The prison needs to be close to hospitals and other services like that. And they also need to be close to the families of the inmates. Mm-hmm. So that means you have to be a short distance to an urban center.
You know, and the other thing is volunteers. I mean, there are hundreds and thousands of volunteers that really help make things work out there for inmates, doing everything from religious ministering to, you know, schooling and some health volunteers. And that's a big issue, too. Mm-hmm.
801-355-TALK is our number. Steve, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-8255. Let's move on to Pioneer Park. And, Chris, you've been covering this sort of evolving debate over whether or not to relocate the homeless shelter and allow development, improvement in the Rio Grande neighborhood. The Pioneer Park Coalition, again, taking some heat from homeless service providers. What's the latest?
Well, the latest surrounds a request that the Pioneer Park Coalition made to the legislature for $1 million to build a housing complex that would be suited and aimed at folks who are now homeless. And so the Pioneer Park Coalition sort of formed itself about a year ago. And basically it was the central core of that was an executive committee made up of various business interests in the area. But they invited everybody to join them. They invited the homeless service providers. They invited, you know, various government agencies. They just invited everybody. Come on, join us. We'll talk about this thing and we'll get it, you know, we'll make it right. So they took their proposal to Capitol Hill and listed 85 of some 300 members, they claim. So it turns out that their definition of membership is if you go to their meetings, you're a member. So you don't really sign up. So what happened was that within that proposal, there were two specific sites mentioned on the west side. And that immediately got hackles up. And then service providers began to realize that their names were on this proposal that they really knew a little about and that they didn't really give consent to have their names being used. Mm-hmm. So what we've seen in the past week is, I think we've had three different stories now where various service providers and government agencies have said, oh no, our name shouldn't be on that. And so this has sort of sent shockwaves through the coalition leadership because they thought that everybody was going to be very happy supporting the $1 million.
And what would that $1 million be used for?
Well, it would be used for housing. It'd go through the Olene Walker Trust.
Loan fund, excuse me.
I always get that wrong. Loan fund. And then it would be, and then that fund would dole it out to a project, a proposal that it thought worthy. Now, the Pioneer Park Coalition says it has another $3 million and that it would, you know, apply for this other, so they'd get about $4 million and they could build one of these housing projects. which is permanent supportive housing. So they take the more chronic homeless people, they give them a house, an apartment, but they also give them counseling. Everybody has a caseworker, and they're, you know, they're nurtured within this housing by these various agencies, and that idea is everybody seems to think that's a great idea, and that's the way that you get these most difficult cases, these folks off the streets, and they're the ones who sort of can't make it back by themselves. So everybody supports that, but what everybody doesn't support is a West Side location, and also the fact that these folks didn't realize they were actually members. They were just sort of participants. And so there's a lot of confusion.
And mm-hmm. to sort of piggyback on that, I think some of the dissent in the executive committee has caused some consternation at the legislature, because they are looking for some money from the legislature for this. And some of the legislators are like, well, what kind of organization are we giving money to if they don't know who's on their executive committee? They're kind of concerned about maybe people angling for some property development, a windfall on property development.
It's hard not to have a united voice.
Yeah.
I mean, they know very well who's on their executive committee, and that's the issue here is that most of these folks listed as members are saying the executive committee, which is a small group of individuals, business owners, are kind of using the homeless services providers as dressing, and they're not really bringing them along. It was like the warden said in Cool Hand Luke, what you have here is a failure to communicate, and I think that's really at the heart of the problem. They're not telling these folks, you know, here's the exact proposal we're bringing to the legislature. We're going to list you as a member. Those are pretty basic things that you need to do when you have a group like this.
Mm-hmm. Again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. If you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is the number. Let's go back to the phones, and Tom is calling from Salt Lake City. Tom, hello.
Hello. I just wanted to weigh in. I was listening to your program as I ran some errands or pulled over. The subject of the Utah State Fairgrounds and its 50-year lease, 40 or 50-year lease, which the Utah legislature approved back in 2010, but still hasn't been signed by the governor. This hesitancy or delaying tactic in following through with what the legislature had already approved to sign a longer lease with the Fairgrounds Corporation, the entity that manages the Utah State Fair Park, has cost the state of Utah a potential, you know, and therefore all the people in the state of Utah who value the state fairgrounds as a historical asset, you know, an icon of the history of the state of Utah that actually has more historical longevity by about 10 years than the state capitol building. It was put into place as the state fairgrounds about 10 years before the state capitol building was built. So it's really a significant icon to the history of Utah, and it has a current use to showcase the agricultural and manufacturing productivity of the state of Utah. And the governor's hesitancy has just recently cost about $18 million to the state citizens by having Mr. Hansen of the Salt Lake Real pull out his offer to construct, to pay for the entire cost of construction of an 8,000-seat soccer stadium on the fairgrounds. That would have been a great enhancement, along with completing the rodeo arena, which had not been completed, even though the plans were there and it was begun.
I'm going to have to interrupt. But because we're running short on time, but I hear your frustration about the Real Salt Lake Monarchs deal falling through this week. And Dan, describe what the proposal was that was on the table and why Deloy Hansen, the owner of Real Salt Lake, decided to withdraw.
Is it Tom, the caller? Was
yes.
That his name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was correct. I mean, that Deloy Hansen, who's a successful businessman and owns RSL, said that he would pour that money, $18 million, into building the new facility, and not only building the soccer stadium, but also, you know, some new entranceway from North Temple into the fairgrounds, and really get a start on helping that become a more feasible facility, because it really has struggled financially over the years. Mm-hmm. But the legislature, in its first hearing, you know, struggled to come up with that. And it was this commitment, this long-term commitment about saying, you know, we're going to keep the fairgrounds there for another 50 years. There was real hesitation about that. And that was key to Hansen's offer, that he wanted assurances he wasn't going to build this facility, and then it was sold out from under him. And the legislature, and I don't know whether it was the governor's office, Tom seems to indicate that's where most of the opposition is coming from, but there was real hesitation in the legislature. And Delroy Hansen said, you know, just yesterday, he said, look, I wanted to do this, it was a great idea, but I don't have the time to sit up there and lobby the legislature and push for this. If the state doesn't want it, I'll go do this somewhere else.
So what does that mean for the State Fair Park, Robert? I mean, what are we hearing on the Hill to the future of the State Fair Park?
Yeah, and I was going to mention that I don't want to give Tom or anybody else too much false hope, but just last night there was a new bill that came out dealing directly with the lease issue at the Fair Park. And so there may still be some time to get some movement on that. But right now, I mean, if Delroy Hansen has said that he's going to pull the plug, I mean, I guess he could put the plug back in. But, you know, it did take an inordinately long time to sort of get this thing moving. And so he seemed to have gotten frustrated with it. But there is, like I mentioned, Representative Frohr has a bill that came out just last night dealing with the lease issue at the Fair Park. And sometimes bills that come out this late don't get through the process, so we'll just kind of have to see what happens in the next 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Tom. 801-355-TALK is our number. We're talking about the week's top stories. You're invited to chime in as well. You can put your comments at sltrib.com or give us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And here in studio, Dan Harry, Robert Gerke, Rebecca Walsh, Chris Smart. We're all here. And if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We are at our final segment, Underplayed Story of the Week, the story that may have fallen under the radar. And Rebecca, do you want to start us off this week?
Sure. I think that for me, the most underreported story was the governor allowing the trimmed down education budget to go through without his signature. And he registered a little minor complaint with a quote. But basically, this seems to be the new normal now for education. They had to cut 2% from their budget, which was millions and millions of dollars taken away from schools. And lawmakers said, oh, we're in such a flush year, we'll come up with some more money for you, don't worry. But this basically sets up a pattern now where they can go to the schools and say, we want you to cut 2% this year. So the school budgets continue to diminish, and they give them one-time funding and say, it'll be okay. Eventually, this is going to hit the wall. There won't be enough funding for schools, and they're going to have to raise these budgets back up again.
Well, just to jump in, all of the budgets got cut by 2%.
Right.
And it's just sort of an exercise that they were doing.
It's a budgeting exercise.
It's a budgeting exercise. Now, the issue that the governor had was that it moved money. It took the 2% and then moved money from public schools to charter schools. And that's a policy decision that the legislature is going to have to ratify later in the session. But the governor didn't like it. And so he let it become.
He didn't like it.
Without his signature.
Okay.
But he didn't use any political capital to fight for public schools either. Because he's only focused on Healthy Utah and the prison, apparently.
Healthy Utah prison, education funding. Chris Smart, what have you got?
This is not an underreported story, but this is the most riveting serial story, at least for me, that's been coming out in the Tribune this week, is the murder trial of Johnny Wall, who's accused of murdering his ex-wife with Xanax, and then she drowned in a bathtub. Jessica Miller has been covering this for us, and it's had a parade of witnesses this week that have outlined a very interesting case. I'd hate to be on the jury, but brick by brick, the prosecution is painting this case where Johnny Wall killed his ex-wife after 5 years of disputes and wrangling.
And there's a lot of family drama because the kids are testifying as well.
Indeed. There are four children, and it's a very sad story, but it's some kind of a special whodunit kind of thing surrounds it.
Check out Jessica Miller's stories on the Johnny Wall case at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, what you got?
I would say the push to reform the criminal justice system in Utah. We've seen this in other states. We're seeing it in Utah now. There hasn't been a whole lot reported about it because the bill took a long time to prepare. It's come out now. They're going to have a first committee hearing for it today. But the idea behind it is we need to get away from the get tough, lock them up and throw away the key to saying, look, these folks are going to be out in society. If they're involved in drug crimes, particularly, which is, I think, accounts for about 30% or so of the 30% of the prisoners, then we should be focusing on treatment first and not locking them up. Part of this is expense, but it's really fascinating because you see the left and the right, the political left and right, converge on this, and it looks like it's got a good shot of happening.
Mm-hmm. Robert, your selection.
Well, I live in the legislative bubble, so I'm picking a legislative story. Last year, the legislature came to this agreement with the Count My Vote people who were running this petition to try to change the way candidates are nominated so you could gather signatures instead of going through the caucus convention system to get on the ballot. This week, the Republican Party said, well, we can't possibly meet these deadlines. We want you to delay it from 2016 to 2018. And they threw in the little bonus to the Republican legislature that if you don't do this, you guys might not end up on the ballot as Republicans. The Republican Senate completely obliterated the proposal to delay it until 2018. So it looks like, unless things change in the last 2 weeks, that the Count My Vote compromise language will go forward and be the way we nominate candidates in 2016.
2016 it is. Well, okay.
There is that lawsuit going on in court. Yeah. The Utah Republican Party has sued over it.
There's a lot of drama on how names get put on the ballot. I guess my pick is one that I wanted to talk about in length, but Chris, we ran out of time. The golf course controversy in Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City Council putting a new vision for the golf courses this week, converting a couple of them into parks, one turning it over to the airport. I guess my question for you is, why is a park cheaper than a golf course? Because you still have to water the lawn, right? And you're not making money.
There's a different level of maintenance, and the golf fund is independent of the city's general fund. So the parks get funded through the general fund, and the golf has to be self-funding. So this decision was after 1 year of serious discussion, two consultant reports, one citizens panel report, and a report from the University of Utah, and one from Westminster College.
Okay. So is it a done deal, or does the mayor have to approve?
Okay. So they want to, the council suggested giving Wing Point to Salt Lake City International Airport and turning Glendale and Nibley into parks. That is now square on the mayor's desk. We will know more about this when his budget comes out in May. And part of the trick of this whole process is that the council has suggested a general obligation bond that would go to the voters, and that would be the method by which these golf courses were changed to parks financially.
It also mentioned Nibley as a possibility.
Yeah, Nibley. Yeah, well, Nibley, and Nibley's a strange case because there may be a language in an agreement from the family that if Salt Lake City doesn't use that for golf, then the family gets it back. But that's under a legal review. Right,
okay,
now.
Lots to watch. Chris Smart, Dan Harry, Robert Gerke, Rebecca Walsh, all of the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too. We'll wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, he is already making plans for next Valentine's Day.
Romance means a lot more to women than it does to men. Not only is it different, but it means a lot more. And so men really have to work at Valentine's Day. Women don't. All they have to do is smile.
There's pressure.
Yeah, there's pressure, especially, you know, if you want to get it exactly right and you haven't been paying attention.
Well, for those who are preparing for next year, you have assembled a list of guidelines, hard lessons that you've learned over the years.
Things that men should focus on when they're trying to make some romantic gesture to their significant other. And it came down to dinner, flowers, candy, jewelry, and a nice card. In this column I wrote in 2009, I said, dinner. Any fool can take a woman someplace nice. You also have to know her history with the place. Is it where she once broke up with a boyfriend or dropped a steak in her lap? If the two of you got engaged to each other there, it's probably okay. Flowers. Quick, what's her favorite flower? That's what I thought. You better find out by Friday at least. An overlooked allergy to roses can be a real buzz killer. Candy. Chocolate is fairly safe, but pay attention to the other ingredients. Nothing says I'm not in the mood tonight quite like anaphylactic shock. She might get the wrong idea about your idea. Jewelry. Unless you already know what she's had her eye on here, it's best to leave this one alone entirely. And I mean completely alone. A gift card for the Walmart jewelry counter isn't going to cut it. Card. A nice Valentine's card is always a good idea, particularly one crammed with cash. But remember that they still read it. Avoid cards featuring words like buddy and friend and for a favorite nephew.
Have you ever made any of these mistakes?
Yeah, I did a couple of times.
What happened?
I had to be pointedly reminded that she had talked about this before and I shouldn't do that. But my wife is actually fairly easy when it comes to romance. All I have to do is basically just take her somewhere to dinner and she's happy just to get out of the house for a while.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can read more Kirby at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks so much to Jesse Ellis and Max McLeod for their help today. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.